Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Dr. Caroline Roberts. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you.
So on our show today, we're going to actually have a conversation that we recently had with a biochemist and author of a new book called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You, Sylvia Tara, who will be talking about the misguided war we're waging. And I know you probably see a lot of patients who are overweight and obese.
Yes, tons.
Yeah. Hard thing to do, and anything we can do to help, it's good, right?
Yes, absolutely.
No downside.
Better.
No downside. Well, let's try to understand some research that matters better today. And let's talk about our very first research that matters, talking about trusting your doctor. Does that help if you trust your doctor, and can that reduce pain? It's interesting.
Yeah, where I work, I see a lot of patients that are from Burlington, North Carolina, which is where I grew up. And when I disclose that I'm from Burlington and we talk about our high school and maybe some sports rivalries between local high schools, it really helps patients open up, which I never, ever anticipated would be true, but it's really helped me establish some good relationships with patients.
Well, this is some interesting research that says, does that matter? And specifically, they were thinking about, does it matter, for instance, in if you do a procedure that maybe causes pain, if people trust their doctor, are they less likely to experience pain during a procedure, which I find a really interesting question. This was research that was done out of the University of Colorado with some colleagues at the University of Miami and published in the Journal of Pain. What were they talking about?
So they were discussing this doctor, Dr. Lawson's lab, where she studies patients and different clinicians and studies their interactions to determine if social and cultural factors influence the pain that patients experience during their medical care. Her main goal was to try and find ways to help people feel less pain when seeing the doctor and help reduce phobias when they come for checkups.
And what they were looking at is if this concordance between a person's core personal beliefs and values, could they like tell the patient that, based upon that, talk to your doctor, and your doctor probably you're matched with the doctor, simulated perhaps doctor in this case, who shared those values. And then they gave an exposure with someone getting a hot pack or something warm on their arm, which could be uncomfortable. Did those people who knew that their doctor was going to share some values and they had a chance to make that bond experience less pain? And indeed, they did.
They reported that when patients felt like they trusted their doctor and felt similar to them, they reported less pain from feeling the heat on their arm. They also showed that they experienced a smaller sense of anxiety on a day-to-day basis in their relationship with their doctor.
You know, I started wondering, what if you were to go in to have a colonoscopy, which is a kind of a standard procedure that you don't think about, like, does the doctor make a difference? But I also recognize that a lot of my patients ask for a specific gastroenterologist who they've had it with before. They want to go back to the same person, presumably that they trust that doctor. I bet it may operate the same way.
I think so. I mean, I definitely picked who I was going to let deliver me and my baby based on my relationship with her. So I think it's a very important thing.
It's good then for trust between a doctor and a patient. You can't always pick the doctor who matches everything that you have, but it may be important to at least share some values that could be really important, like a dedication to the doctor-patient relationship.
Anything to make my patients take their medicines is a helpful thing for me.
Just a little bit of sugar helps the medicine go
exactly.
down.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about sugar. Let's talk about the next research that matters. That's about diabetes and the risk for cancer. I was like, huh, I thought diabetes maybe had a higher risk of some cancers, but this was looking at brain cancer and maybe something different.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. I was not expecting to ever hear that diabetes caused a lower incidence of cancer, but there's a study that has come out of a center in Ohio State led by Judith Schwartzbaum, who has studied that diabetes and elevated blood sugar actually lead to a decreased incidence of a certain type of brain cancer called a glioma.
And they can be obviously cancerous and cause people to die. And she was looking at research that actually came from two cohorts, large cohorts, over 500,000 people in Sweden, and this was published in the journal Scientific Reports. And what'd she find?
Well, she found that diabetes and elevated blood sugar helps decrease the risk of gliomas. It's actually a protective mechanism. Decreases.
Okay.
Protective mechanism against reducing their risk for developing this type of brain cancer.
And it's really kind of interesting. They don't really have a great explanation for that. There could be something about the gliomas. They tend to require blood sugar more than perhaps some other tumors. I was also wondering about the role of some things like in the environment, like cigarettes. We know that tobacco use is a cause of diabetes, and that diabetes, tobacco use can also cause cancer. So maybe there's some what we call confounding going on here with some of these relationships where they think it's the diabetes, but maybe some other factor.
Yeah, I would like to think that they protected against the confounding, but you never know. It'd be a really interesting study to delve into a little bit further.
Yeah, well, we know people are hearing about it. We wanted to bring this research forward.
I still don't think I'd tell my patients to get diabetes if their risk of glioma was pretty high.
Just to reduce that risk of glioma.
I
don't think so either. Well, this next research that matters, we think, is directly relevant to virtually anyone who knows adolescent, middle school, high school, has a child, was a child. I think that's just about everyone.
Yes.
At least in the United States. What are we talking about?
So we're talking about bullying, especially bullying in the United States. And the great news is that there has been a new study out of a school district in Maryland that actually has proven that they think that bullying rates may be decreasing in the United States.
Yeah, this was in the journal Pediatrics. And researchers from the University of Virginia were studying what was happening in Maryland between 2005 and 2014. And basically, across many different ways that they measured it, both kids reporting bullying, kids reporting being bullied, over 246,000 4th through 12th graders in 109 schools showed that there were pretty dramatic decreases that seemed to accelerate in the last few years.
Yeah, they reported that rates of being bullied decreased from about 29% to about 13%. And rates of being a bully decreased from about 21% to 7%.
Yeah, this is, I think, you know, it's good news. It's certainly perhaps some evidence that some of the attention, that doesn't mean bullying is not occurring. We know it does. We also know that violence is a significant problem. You know, these were schools across Maryland. We also know that, you know, in Baltimore this year in 2017, there's been a dramatic surge. Baltimore is one of the most violent cities right now in the United States, worse than Chicago, New York, Washington. So we know that we can't just like say, oh, we're doing good with bullying. We don't have to worry about violence. But I still think this is good news.
Yeah, I think so. And one thing that I really appreciated about this study is it not only reported that bullying was decreasing, but it also showed the most effective ways to decrease bullying in terms of school-based policies. So they reported the most successful anti-bullying programs were science-based, which I always love, intensive. They involved the school. They engaged students as well as teachers and parents. And they teach students problem-solving skills, empathy, perspective-taking, and how to be a positive bystander.
Good things all.
I think so.
Let's talk about our last research that matters. It's about actually lack of health insurance and how much death and disease that may cause. It was a legislator, I think, in Idaho recently who actually said no one's ever died from lack of health care. So those of us who are health services researchers went, there's some data out there that really contradicts that. This is that type of data.
Yes. This I very passionately was glad to have read this article. It was published in the American Journal of Public Health, and they discovered that actually about 45,000 deaths annually are linked to lack of health care coverage.
45,000.
45,000.
Wow. Because one of their estimates a decade ago was that it could be 15 to 18,000. And it seems like with more data, they really have pretty good estimates that this is a major preventable cause of death and disease.
Yes. As two primary care doctors, I think both you and I recognize, Dr. Goldstein, that we have the tools at our hands that are easy to prevent bad outcomes from stuff like hypertension and diabetes and kidney disease. But we have to see those patients. We have to prescribe those medicines for them to be able to prevent these bad outcomes.
Yeah, I know that President Trump, when talking about from the Prime Minister from Australia, was talking about and really applauding what they've done in Australia with their healthcare and recognizing that their healthcare has some advantages over ours, and one of them is this universal healthcare. It's got to be a goal we aspire to.
Yes.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear of a recent conversation we had with biochemist and author of The Secret Life of Fat, Dr. Sylvia Tara, about the misguided battle of the bulge. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson and Dr. Carolyn Roberts. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with biochemist and author of a new book, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You, with Dr. Sylvia Tara about the misguided battle of the bulge. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Tara.
Thank you so much. So nice to be here.
First off, how did you get interested in medical writing or research, because your path perhaps is not so obvious?
Yeah, no, well, welcome the question. So, you know, for me, I always struggled with fat ever since I was a little kid. I actually gained weight very, very easily, and I went on a number of different diets, and, you know, sometimes I'd lose a few pounds, and, you know, they would come back eventually, and honestly, on some diets, I could even gain weight. And I struggled with this for years, and then finally, you know, after a couple of kids, the fat got very, very stubborn. And I was about to go on yet another diet. There's always a new diet of the decade. And I thought, you know, before I go on one more diet, I really want to understand fat. I had noticed people around me eat whatever they like and not gain weight. I had noticed some that didn't exercise much or very little. And I felt like I was doing all the right things I'm supposed to do, and yet my fat just wouldn't move. And so I thought, before I take anyone else's advice anymore, I really need to understand my own fat. It's behaving differently than everyone else's. I am a scientist by training. I'm a biochemist. And I thought, well, if anyone can understand fat, I should be able to understand fat. And so I went on a mission, and I read through just thousands of articles, really, on fat in the scientific literature. I interviewed dozens of scientists around the world about their latest research on fat. What I was finding was just so astounding that I decided I really should write this in a book and share it with everybody. And that's what The Secret Life of Fat is. It's all the very interesting things I found out about fat that I put in a book and tried to make it very easy to read for people. And hopefully it really helps people understand their own fat.
Well, let's start with just a definition, because I think when we talk about and hear the title, The Secret Life of Fat, it raises a question. What are we really talking about? Are we talking about fat as a noun? Are we talking about fat as an adjective? And I will have more to say, but I'm just kind of curious, what are your thoughts?
What is fat, right? So I think the most interesting thing I learned is that fat is not just fat. We think of it as a reserve of calories. It's just storing energy, and we have to get rid of it at all costs. You know, in truth, fat is something very different. It's actually an endocrine organ, meaning that it releases hormones into our body, hormones that our body desperately needs. And in fact, there's a lot of problems that we get if we don't have enough fat. And there are people who have a disease called lipodystrophy who don't make fat in sufficient amounts, and they have a whole host of health problems. So I think the most interesting thing is that, you know, fat releases hormones. It's not just sitting there. And, you know, one of the hormones it makes is leptin. And leptin actually has vast influence on our bodies. It actually can control appetite. It can influence our thoughts about food. It can affect metabolism, so that when we lose some fat, we're actually decreasing the amount of hormones it's putting into our bodies. And that causes real hunger. It causes lower metabolism. It actually causes us to want to put the weight back on. And so I think we have to think of fat differently. You can't just think of it as something I have to get rid of. It's actually a critical component of your body, and you have to understand that. You have to know what tricks fat has to come back on, because it does try to come back on you, and your body wants it to stay on. You know, we want to lose fat. We don't value it, but our body really does, and so fat will fight to come back on us.
You really talk about, you know, fat as a vital organ scientifically. But it's always – we're balanced out by culturally what people's perceptions of being fat or having excess tissue. What do we know historically about fat that may help us understand why we're at where we are today, where we think everyone needs to be on a low fat, even if they don't have much fat?
That's a really interesting question. In fact, I have a chapter on the history of how we perceived fat. And actually, fat was not always hated in the U.S. In fact, fat was quite loved for quite a time. There was, you know, a time after the Civil War where, you know, there was poverty, there was destruction, and food was hard to come by. And in that time, fat was really loved. People wanted to have fat. In fact, there were celebrities who had fat, and they would do very well. People would pad themselves to look like some of these celebrities. You know, even the medical profession was not so against fat at that time either. There was even a club called the Fat Men's Club founded in Connecticut where men had to be fat enough to join because it was such a symbol of prestige. The change came when the economy improved in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, and industrialization brought in jobs, and then food wasn't so hard to come by anymore, and more people started having fat. And then that's when there was more warning by the government, more warning by medical leaders, by religious leaders about fat, about the nation getting really heavy. And that's when a lot of businesses started taking advantage, entrepreneurs, small business type people selling little gimmicks to get rid of your fat. There was rubber suits to sweat away fat. Tapeworms were even sold that you could swallow, and they would you know, suck up your calories so that you wouldn't get fat. You know, fat off soap that was supposed to release fat under the skin. Just a lot of little gimmicks. And that became another voice in the echo chamber telling everyone you shouldn't have fat. And it eventually led to a very self-conscious, you know, nation about their own fat. And so it's taken on a life of its own just about now to where, we spend more than $60 billion a year trying to get rid of fat, which is more than we spend actually on the war on terror. And yet fat keeps coming back. And so we're not doing very well at understanding our fat and winning this war. And I feel like we really need to understand fat at a much deeper level if we're really going to try to win this battle that we have with it. But, you know, fat, it was admired in the past. It's almost gone to the point of we worry too much about it. And I'm hoping my book, The Secret Life of Fat, puts some balance back into the perspective that we don't want to get rid of all our fat. Fat is, in fact, really important to us. Having too much is certainly not good. That can lead to a lot of health issues. But having none, or this perception that it's very bad and we should get rid of it at all costs, is also not very healthy.
We also know that some people are prone to carrying different amounts of fat. What do we know about how people respond and why do some people really have so much more fat than other people?
Yeah, now that's a great question. And I have a whole section of The Secret Life of Fat devoted to that. Genetics plays a big part into how we carry our fat and where it is and even how much it is. There's certain gene mutations that are correlated with fat that either affect appetite or they affect fat creation in us. You know, certainly as we age, that's going to matter. As our hormones like testosterone, growth hormone, estrogen start to wane, we start to gain weight. And men will gain it more in their bellies. Women will gain it more in their thighs and their buttocks and hips. And so our hormones will affect fat distribution as well. Bacteria that we carry, so, you know, we all get inhabited by bacteria as we go through lives. And certain types of bacteria in our gut will extract more food than other types. And that bacteria set, the microbiome, as it's called, it also differs by family. There's a family component to that. So, you know, there are genetics that are at play with it. There are, you know, our microbiome. There's our age. Gender is a very big influence, too. Women partition more nutrients into their fat than men do. And women also respond to the hunger hormone ghrelin quite differently. So after exercise, they actually get more hungry than men do. So it's really, there's so many reasons why we have fat in different places, and some people have more and some people have less. And, you know, that really, having that knowledge really helped me understand my own fat, because I think so many of us are prone to feeling guilty, like we're doing something wrong. We're just not following a diet right. So many diet books say it's easy. You just follow these steps, 1, 2, 3, and you'll lose weight. But it's really not easy. And people are so individual with their body types and how they gain, that if you've ever had resistant fat, you really need to understand your fat really well so you can, you know, one, stop feeling so guilty, two, start getting on a track where you're doing something that works for your body type. Someone who's 50 years old, perhaps have had a couple kids, they're not going to lose weight as easily as their neighbor who's 22-year-old. especially if it's a male neighbor, right? There's going to be a very big difference. And so I think we have to stop comparing ourselves to some norm and start individualizing our diet plans and understanding our own body needs better.
We're going to need to take a short break, but there's so many questions we want to get into, particularly about your views on treatment and where we need to go and help people understand how the image versus even reality. But lots of things to talk about. We're talking with our great guest, Dr. Sylvia Tara, about the Secret Life of Fat, a new book, an important new book she has. And we're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with your health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with biochemist and author Dr. Sylvia Tara about her new book, The Secret Life of Fat. And right before the break, Dr. Tara, you were really helping us understand, I think, this conception and culture and genetics. One thing we probably should just talk about and hear your thoughts on, you did come across a lot of medical research about the adverse effect of too much fat, obesity, correct?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, just like having too little fat is not healthy because your fat's really important, having too much fat is also not healthy at all. And that's one of the things that we keep hearing about fat. That's what makes most of the headlines all the time. So there's different types of fat in your body, and that's the first thing people have to understand. There's subcutaneous fat, which is the fat right underneath your skin. And that's, you know, a healthy deposit of fat. There's a very unhealthy deposit of fat, which is in your visceral area, and that's fat underneath your stomach wall that's nestled up against your internal organs. When we get too much fat, particularly too much visceral fat, it starts to become inflamed. Your fat cells get very crowded. They start to suffocate. They put out a distress signal. That recruits a lot of immune cells and immune signals to your visceral fat. And what that does is that it starts to interfere with insulin signaling, meaning we're not as responsive to insulin as before. And that causes a lot of problems. We don't internalize the cholesterol and fats out of our blood. They tend to hang around more. It has potential to lead to diabetes, to coronary disease. And so having too much fat is really something to watch for. Although having a healthy amount, you know, is just fine. And actually being even a 5 pounds overweight or so, you know, it's not terrible. It's when we accumulate too much visceral fat.
When people say, you know, they come into the doctor and the doctor says, you're obese, you're overweight, you really need to lose some weight, and the patient's okay, and the doctor says, go on a low-fat diet. Is that the right approach? What do you recommend? Because obviously the doctor may mean one thing, the patient may understand something else.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, for a diet to work, it has to work for someone biologically. And I laid out a number of different biological components to us. I mean, there's genetics, there's age, there's, you know, all kinds of reasons why we might be fat, why we might have to modulate our diet a little bit. In fact, there's excellent research done on types of food that, you know, eating sweets does not have the same effect on everybody. Some people can get away with it, some people can. So we do need to modulate for the diet, modulate biologically how we're going to react. But secondly, the diet has to work for you psychologically. You have to be able to stay on the diet. And it has to be able to work for you socially, that you can fit it into your lifestyle. And so all those three components have to come together for a diet to work. And so I do think that doctors, this is a great book for doctors, really, because it helps them get very educated about what fat is, why it's important, why bodies will fight to hold on to it. They could also have patients that are trying very hard to lose weight, but they're not, and they're not losing weight. And it's not because they're not trying. And when I spoke to a number of obesity specialists, people who have weight loss programs, you know, they talk about this all the time. Some patients have to make a much more drastic effort than others. And, you know, fat takes a very long time to come off. And so I think there needs to be some flexibility in how we, you know, approach obesity, you know, some appreciation for what patients actually go through. It's incredibly hard to do this. You know, one piece of research I came across that I think is helpful is that fat produces a hormone called leptin. So when we lose fat, we lose leptin, and that makes us hungrier. It makes fat come back much more easily because our metabolism goes down. And what they find is that people who have gained weight and lost weight, 10% of their weight, have to eat 22% fewer calories than somebody who's naturally at that weight to begin with, which means there's a caloric penalty for losing weight. And if you're not aware of this, you know, number one, you might be telling patients to eat more than they actually should to maintain a weight. But two, you might not realize how much more drastically they need to cut to lose weight. So there's a lot of advice, you know, for physicians in the book, I think. I mean, one is the persistence that people have to stay on it, understanding what your patients go through, and truly understanding the different ways people get fat and how fat will fight back in order to help your patients stay on a diet.
I started a weight management program at the University of North Carolina along with my colleagues a year or so ago because we were just, I think, overwhelmed, not with just how many people needed to lose weight, but the fact that there wasn't enough resources helping them and how difficult it was. And I think too many doctors want a quick fix. A lot of patients know quick fixes don't work, and I reminded that when you lose weight and regain it, it's in that kind of cycling, it's worse than if you perhaps had never lost that weight. So this commitment, I love your biological, psychological, and social approach. Have you been able to think about how your book could work in conjunction with programs to help motivate? What do you hope happens?
Sure. You know, one thing I've learned right off the bat is that knowledge is power. And so certainly when I gained all this knowledge about fat, what it is, how it fights back, all the different ways we get fat, I felt so empowered. It's like when I got hungry, I understood exactly why I was hungry. My ghrelin levels were going up. My leptin was down. You know, at the night stage is when some of those things surge more than others. Some of these hunger signals surge more. And just knowing what was going on in my body helped me maintain on a program. I didn't feel like, well, I'm getting hungry because I'm failing on a diet. I'm supposed to not be hungry on this diet. That's what the book tells me. And therefore, I'm doing something wrong and I'm just going to give up. You know, I really felt empowered to take on fat. I understood now everything about it. I knew what it was going to take to get it off. And I was able to stay on it permanently. And I've had permanent weight loss from just having that knowledge. It also helped me not follow siren songs and not go on this latest fad of the day, you know, of how like eating all pasta is supposed to work or eating no pasta is supposed to work. I feel like I don't have to take someone else's advice anymore. I've got enough knowledge. I can navigate on my own. And I found the diet that works for me. And that was only through really understanding, you know, the biology of fat and what it really meant for me. You know, I could vouch for other people. I know my editor who had to edit my book, he lost 15 pounds. And it was really just the knowledge that he got from reading it. You know, again, knowledge was power. I profiled one of the patients in the book, too, and he had struggled with weight for decades, really. And he finally got into a university program where they taught him about fat. He had two classes a week, you know, every month. This went on for a while. And he said the knowledge about fat, knowing, understanding weight set points, understanding how we accumulate fat, some people accumulate it, you know, differently than others for different reasons, also empowered him to really stay on a diet. So what I'm hoping happens with The Secret Life of Fat is people have an aha moment, particularly if you've had very resistant, stubborn fat, you've tried diets, they've not worked. Have this knowledge, let it, you know, seep in and use it to tweak your diet. You know, I do have a little bit of advice on things that seem to cut across and be effective across a number of different diets. There's certain ways to eat. We usually, you know, a lot of books talk about insulin, but there's a whole host of other hormones that we can eat around and try to modulate as well with food and exercise. There's a lot of benefits to certain types of exercise, and they cut across any kind of diet you might want to try. So I'm hoping some of that advice as well, people find a diet's not working for them, they can incorporate some of these different elements and kickstart the diet and make it start working for them.
In terms of, like, you know, people ask just a basic question, would a low-fat diet or a low-carbohydrate diet work better for me in general? What do you say?
So, you know, insulin is a very important hormone to manage. And so when we have way too many carbs or too much sugar and we're constantly provoking insulin, we can get insulin resistant. So I think insulin is a really important hormone to manage in your body. That doesn't mean no sugar or no carbs. And I've tried no-carb diets before. I find that lifestyle component and that psychological component for me just don't work. I found it too hard to stay on for the long run. And if you can't stay on it for the long run, it's not the diet for you. So managing it, I mean, that doesn't mean you can't have no sweets, but it means, you know, if you really want to have some carb in your life, you can, but I think it's important not to have too much. You know, at the same time, there's other hormones that are really important that don't get talked about a lot. You know, I think there's a dozen books on insulin and carb, low-carb diets, but very little about the importance of growth hormone or testosterone, which are great fat-busting hormones. And, you know, actually, there's ways to provoke them to release. Intermittent fasting actually extends the release of growth hormone, and that'll bust through fat, really stubborn fat. There's exercises that help promote the release of testosterone and growth hormone, and that'll also kickstart a weight loss. And so I really will hope that people think more comprehensively about fat, not one-dimensionally, which are mostly what diet books are. They get on one platform, one idea, and they write 200 pages about it. But there's so much more to fat to know, especially if you've had a hard time on the diet of the day. So, you know, I think fat also, that's another, you know, area that you brought up. I also think that's an important part of a diet. I've never been a big proponent of low-fat diets. I find it's not satiating. Enough research has come out now that it's not necessarily even healthy. Some people who have it have, you know, higher bad cholesterol than good cholesterol, and, you know, that's a very good area worth watching, too. But again, balance and having something work, a diet work biologically, socially, psychologically, for the long haul is what people really have to try to achieve.
Well, I think that you're well on your way. I love the Knowledge is Power. We're talking with Dr. Sylvia Tara about her new book, The Secret Life of Fat. And I don't know if it's secret anymore. We really appreciate your being with Your Health today, because this is, we're all in it together. And it really does take a village, I think, to deal with this public health issue. Thanks so much for being with Your Health today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love being here.
We're going to take a short break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Carolyn, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns. And if they have a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they just send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We're going to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first question.
My doctor recently retired, and I'm currently trying to find a new one. As I've been looking around, I've noticed that I'm seeing doctors called internists, primary care physicians, family doctors, etc. Can you tell me if there's any difference?
Those doctors, can't they just work until they're like in their 80s?
Ever retire.
You know, this is something that we don't think about or talk about as much as when doctors retire and what that actually does to a practice, because it's not like you can just automatically always have a doctor standby to be in that practice to take care of the patients that doctor was seeing. That doctor may have been taking care of 1,500 patients.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, and one that I really truly had a hard time understanding until I myself went to residency in medical school. I would say the way that I would answer this question is the difference to me between internist and primary care doctors and family doctors is really the type of training that they get. Internists typically are doctors that are trained for about 3 years and then have the ability to go on and specialize in something like cardiology or gastroenterology. But when they're in a primary care setting, they can see all sorts of patients. They typically don't see children, and they typically don't do like maternal care, whereas another family doctor is trained as well for about 3 years, typically does not go on to specialize, but typically can see patients like children and pregnant women.
Yeah, and even when we think about sometimes routine gynecologic care like pap smears and maybe bleeding, vaginal bleeding, a number of internists may or may not, depending on their comfort level, do that. A family doctor will routinely pretty much be doing that. So then there's also a question of orientation. A lot of internists have spent a lot more time perhaps looking and experiencing and studying diseases. Family docs may have spent more time thinking about prevention. But there's a lot of crossover. And if you're in your 60s, I think what's far more important is what are your values? We talked about earlier in the show, Carolyn, about, you know, trusting your doctor. You got to trust your doctor. And this is really important to look for that trust regardless of
right.
What their background is.
I agree. I think to me that's the most important.
Good question. Thank you for asking. What's our very next house call, Laura?
My 7-year-old constantly bites his nails and cuticles, sometimes even to the point of bleeding. I've tried to get him to stop, but this habit is a challenging one. What can I do to keep his nails healthy when he bites them, and what can I do to help him quit?
Unfortunately, one of the teachers I had in elementary school hit me with a fly swatter. Don't want that. That was that bullying that we talked about earlier. But you know, this is a significant problem. In the medical terminology, we have a name for it, nail picking disorder,
or onychotillomania. So you've got onychotillomania, not a good
That's
thing.
Scary.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are that I've heard a lot of products out there that could potentially work. I know for a fact that there are certain like nail polishes that people can paint on their children's nails that when they bite them, it tastes very nasty and bitter.
That was placed on my nails growing up.
Didn't work.
Didn't work.
The only thing that worked, my very best friend growing up had onychotillomania. And the only thing that worked for her is that when she got to have partners and boyfriends, nobody would hold her hand. So that's when she stopped.
Yeah, you don't want bleeding hands going, folks. No. You know, I think this is really difficult. There's also a genetic issue here. And so I think, you know, it's much more likely that this is going to be an issue in children. There's some evidence that there's some relationship to obsessive compulsive anxiety. But regardless, you can do medications, these SSRIs. I think the single best thing is cognitive behavioral therapy, along with maybe simply like meditation.
Yeah.
And I find if you can do meditation and deep breathing and maybe have a nail clipper on hand so that you, rather than bite, you can do that. People don't like having painful, swollen, red hands.
Right. Yes. I've heard the same. I think it's the CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, you talked about. But people will say, you know, take a rubber band on your hand and either pop yourself or switch it to the other hand once you realize what you're doing, just to kind of make them aware of what they're doing. Could a 7-year-old do this? Probably. I think a parent can help.
I think anyone can do 4 or 5 deep breaths. That's
yes.
My mantra of life lately, 4 or 5 deep breaths. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I'm a 37-year-old woman with adult acne. It drives me crazy. I really thought I'd be at least a decade past having to buy tons of blemish-fighting products at this point. Any advice?
Well, this gives us more questions than answers, perhaps. I got a lot of questions here.
Yeah, I'd be curious what you tried, and I'd also be curious of some of the other medicines you take. I know with women that have acne, a lot of times it's hormonal-related, so I would want to know if you were on birth control, the type of birth control you're on, what you've tried in the past.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to treat this, too. And you mentioned like hormonal therapy. There's also kind of therapy that helps exfoliate the skin. And those are a lot of the salicylic acid preparations, the things that have lactic acid in them. A lot of those are over-the-counter. Some are prescription. Then there are the things like the retinoids. You've heard of Retin-A, different, a couple of retinoids. And that actually does several different things. And then there's the antibiotics. Those are all kind of like the typical things for mild and moderate acne. If you got severe acne that's scarring, you really do need to see a dermatologist.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of other implications with this, especially as a 37-year-old woman, that we'd want to pick the right medicine, the right cream, and hopefully get you some relief.
Yeah, the right drug for the right price at the right time.
Right.
And unfortunately for you, this is lasting longer, and we know that that's happened. We encourage you to work with your primary care physician, work with the dermatologist if needed. You can definitely get it better. Thanks so much for your question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I went to my dermatologist recently with a bump on my neck. She said this was not a skin condition, but possibly a lymph node, and she recommends removing it. It's only been there for about 4 to 6 weeks, and it's not painful. Do you really think I need to get it removed?
Well, that's a really tough question. Part of it depends on your age, whether or not you smoke or drink excessively. Have you ever had skin cancer before? A lot of questions there. So the answer is it might be and it might not. What do you think?
Yeah, I always trust my colleagues when I send them out. I realize they are consultants, and so they are consulting. But I think that if somebody has recommended that I probably would tend to agree with them.
Yeah, you know, particularly if it's something small in the neck. I mean, we've seen things like lymphoma or other types of cancers present that way, and it's small, easy to take out. And you know what? The worst that happens is you're reassured. The best that happens is you've saved a life. So
right.
Seems like to me the cost-benefit could suggest. Now, you may say, could you wait 4 weeks and see if it goes away? You could. If it was painful, probably not malignancy, probably infection. But I think I like what you're saying.
Yeah, I think there's certain options. You could maybe get it biopsied, but I agree. I think that the risk-benefit is favorable to get it removed.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. And you can share any question or story at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Search for our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest today, Dr. Sylvia Tara, and thanks Dr. Carolyn Roberts for joining us as a co-host on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Carolyn Roberts.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.